I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. Coming up on The Story, Linda Kelso was feeling adventurous. She was a divorcee in her 50s and daydreaming about meeting a nice romantic guy. On a whim, she filled out an online personal profile and uploaded it to an internet social network.
I like complexity, mystery, intrigue, little furry creatures, engineers, students, scientists, cooks, carpenters. What I want out of life, tranquility, a warm place to sleep, someone to talk to.
Now, Linda was delighted by the prompt interest of a guy named Barry. He had a handsome picture, a flirtatious manner, and he wrote to her that he was an international building contractor working on a project in Nigeria. After a few weeks of tender exchanges, Barry sent Linda a message that turned the hearts in her eyes into daggers. Linda Kelso is my guest on The Story, right after the news. Linda Kelso felt a mix of emotions when she clicked the mouse to upload her personal profile. She'd just put herself out there, at age 54 and divorced, on an internet social network. She did it on a lark. She thought, what could it hurt? Maybe I'll be pleasantly surprised. And she was. Almost immediately, Linda got a very friendly message from a guy named Barry. He looked handsome, as far as she could tell from his photo, a smiling, middle-aged gentleman sitting on a boat.
Sort of the sun in his eyes, so he was squinting a bit. Attractive young man.
Linda was charmed by Barry's frequent and flirtatious messages over the next few weeks. So charmed, in fact, that she was willing to shrug off some red flags. Bizarre requests, inquiries about money, and unexplainable inconsistencies in Barry's life story. The reality? Linda was being strung along by an internet scammer to see if she'd take the ultimate bait. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Most online fraud goes unreported. The main reason? People are embarrassed to admit that they got involved with something that was too good to be true. For Linda Kelso, it all began when she signed up for a Yahoo Messenger account.
I've been single for quite a long time, and hope springs eternal in a young woman's heart. Not that I'm all that young, but I would love to have a partner. It's difficult to meet people. I work 7 days a week, and I don't care to go to bars and do that sort of thing. So, you know, I really didn't know fully what it meant to put a profile online. That may seem a bit naive to you, but the messenger just came up and said, do you want to list a profile? And I'm like, sure, why not?
You're talking about your internet messenger.
Right. So I sat down and typed a profile, and then people began to contact me. Actually, I should say just men, as far as I know. When I began to get responses from men, it was like, oh, this is cool. You know, you can talk to somebody and find out a little bit about them and see what happens. And, you know, you get a message on the screen, and you either can respond or not. Most of the time I talk back, say hello, how are you, what's going on, you know, like that.
And your online profile concerning what you're looking for in a partner reads, as I'm going to edit a little bit here, it says,
okay.
I like engineers, students, scientists, cooks, carpenters, and basically anyone who isn't hung up on clothing labels. What I want out of life, tranquility, a chance to create art, a warm place to sleep, someone to talk to. Come visit me online. Now, Linda, it sounds like you're casting a pretty wide net there.
Well, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about what it felt like to, you know, push that upload button and make yourself public, so to speak.
I'm an out there kind of person. I like to be a little bit outrageous. I'm going to have my hair dyed pink on Friday. So that's something I would do. You know, I used to say I would try anything once. Well, there are a few things I've decided to cross off the list, but it was an adventure for me. It was putting myself out to the world. And it was a place where in my profile I could say whatever I wanted to say. And I did.
What kind of response did you get?
I get an amazing lot of responses from relatively young men. 30-somethings are thinking about getting married, and the 40-somethings are married, and they're not happy with their marriage, and they're looking for something. The 50-somethings are more settled. They know what they want. They're the same age as I am. We have the same memories. In some ways, it's the most satisfying to talk to people my own age.
Well, let me ask, if I might, what your love life was like at the time when you'd put this profile up.
What love life?
That's the short answer. Okay.
That is the short answer. There's, it's been a long time. You know, I have a couple of gentlemen friends that I see, but no one's serious. You know, going out for dinner is nice, but one would like a little bit more than that.
Now, once you started having these various communications, once your profile was up online and public, did you have high hopes about finding that perfect someone out there?
You know, I really did at first. I thought, oh, this is great. This will take a couple months. I can get married. I can share my home with someone. But it hasn't turned out that way yet.
Now, if Linda was having trouble finding Mr. Right, it certainly wasn't for lack of eligible online suitors. Plenty of interested men were sending messages to her profile, and one of them really caught her eye. He introduced himself as Barry Mullen.
He had a nice picture online. He was, I would say, somewhere between 48 and 52 looking, sitting on a boat, sort of the sun in his eyes, so he was squinting a bit. Attractive young man. He claimed to be from someplace near Pensacola, Florida. He also claimed to be an engineer who was working in Nigeria on contract for the government, he said.
So he seems like a kind of exciting new character to come into your cyber life. He's got a handsome picture. He's got an interesting job. And what kind of things did he have to say in your communications with each other?
He told me that it was difficult for him to trust people because he had been in some kind of relationship with a woman and she had done him wrong. He spent a lot of money on her, given her a lot of money, and she left him. He said he couldn't trust people anymore. And we chatted. He said, he felt he could trust me. And that, you know, maybe there was hope for relationships among people, you know, stuff like that.
So it sounds like there's a little bit of flirting going on in conversations like this.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yes. One always wants to hear that one is trustworthy and desirable. I'm not into picket fences, but yeah, I was imagining that perhaps when we met, you know, let's just say I was open to the possibility of there being something substantial.
Did you guys ever talk about meeting face-to-face?
Well, he was in Africa, you see, on business, and he said yes. When he got back to the United States, he was going to come and see me.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. Now, over the next few weeks, Linda's online romance with Barry continued to blossom. The thrill and promise of it all was completely intoxicating, so much so that Linda shrugged off some things that should have been serious warning signs.
They began to pop up from the very beginning, and you know how it is. You can look back later and say, oh yeah, that was a red flag. But at the time, you know, if you notice it, you say, oh, that wasn't a red flag. That was a pink flag, you know. I didn't really see that. Then the next one comes up and you're still in denial about red flags because you want it to work out, you know. But from the time he told me he was in Nigeria, I thought, well, maybe if he really is interested in me, if he really does come to see me, maybe he would bring me a piece of cloth that was ethnographic. That is to say, not made for the tourists. I teach how to weave cloth. Mm-hmm. And I've actually studied Nigerian and Ghanaian cloths a little bit. So I queried him a little bit about the cloth, and his response was very vague, very vague. Hmm. So you would come up every day, I feel quite sure, I've never been there, with people wearing those kinds of garments. I can't imagine that you wouldn't. And he seemed so ignorant of that. So I'm thinking, that's odd.
That's a little bit suspicious, that he'd be oblivious to something that would theoretically be all around him if he was in Nigeria.
Right, exactly. And At one point, he asked me to place an ad for him in some kind of online news paper. He said that his sister, who supposedly lived in the Baltimore area, was raising puppies and he wanted me to put this ad. So I did. I did that for him.
Wait, he wanted you to put an ad in the paper to sell his sister's puppies?
Right, right. Okay,
that's pretty weird.
It was weird. And, you know, I've decided that what that was about was to see how cooperative I would be. Just a little test kind of thing. Hmm. But what was weird about it to me was it was all wrong. You know, he said the puppies were hand-raised in her sunroom. And there was three or four disparate breeds. And, you know, it happens also that I know a little bit about puppies. My parents bred German Shepherds when I was a kid, so I know a little bit about puppies. They're very messy and very noisy. The idea of having puppies of several breeds in a small space like a sun porch just didn't seem right to me. When I look back on it, it's amazing how little content there was to the conversation, but it just fascinated me, and it tickled me that someone would respond and say they cared about me and say some of the things that all women like to hear, you know.
She didn't want to admit it to herself. She wished it wasn't true. But Linda had to face the fact that her heartstrings were being played like a fiddle. Barry, with his handsome photo and his lavishing of attention, was a mirage. Worse, really, he was a despicable liar and a crook. Up next, we'll hear about the moment when Linda called him out on the scam.
Well, he said, this is embarrassing. He kept telling me he loved me and he needed someone to receive checks for him because he couldn't cash them in Africa. And I just typed no. And he typed back, no? Are you accusing me of being a scammer? And then I said the thing that I'm most embarrassed about. How stupid can you be, all right? I said to him, but what about us? And I said, what am I thinking? There is no us. There was no us.
Closing the book on a romance that was too good to be true. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. From American Public Media, this is The Story. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story. You know, internet fraud is projected to fleece us to the tune of nearly $4 billion this year. Now, the scams are flourishing because of the anonymity and wide reach of the internet. This hour, we've been hearing the story of Linda Kelso. She met and fell head over heels for a con man on an internet chat site. We're going to get back to Linda's misadventure shortly, but first, let's take a minute to revisit a conversation from a few months ago. You may remember hearing Dick Gordon talk with a man named Dan Giddens. Dan got one of those ubiquitous emails with the Nigerian check cashing scam, and he actually took the bait. To him, it looked like a way to make some easy money.
First of all, it was going to be 10% of everything I did. And then after a month or so I think it was like $10,000 a month, if I did that much, that they would increase the payments to me. And actually, in the beginning, I even had to fill out some type of form for taxes and stuff.
U.S. taxes, Nigerian taxes, U.K.
No,
taxes?
U.S. taxes. U.S. Because I was going to be a home business running it in the U.S. for them over there.
And then they sent you checks?
Yes.
And what did that envelope look like? Do you remember opening it?
Yes, I actually brought them with me here.
Open them up for me, would you? Tell me what
just,
they look like.
It's a UPS Express envelope.
Okay, so that seems legit, right?
Well, that's what I was thinking. I said, we'll see where it goes from here. And on here, it actually was from a person in San Pedro, California.
The check was?
Yeah, that's where they came from. And I have the person's name and actually where he lived and the telephone number.
And the checks made out to who, though, Dan?
Actually, they were made out to me.
To your name?
Yes.
How many checks were in the envelope?
Six checks first time.
And they were all for the same amount of money?
Yes.
How much?
$499.
And what was the deal? Like, was there a letter there that said, you cash these and keep X amount of money and send the rest to us? How did it work?
Okay. Online, through the email, there were explicit directions of what to do. I was to cash them. They would send me 10%, and I would have to send these to Nigeria in Africa.
Now, along about this point, my antenna would go up.
Well, yeah, the antennas were up, and I'm thinking, well, let's see where it goes from here.
Dan explained to Dick Gordon that once he had these dubious checks in hand, he headed to the bank.
They didn't cash the checks, then I know they would be phony, and that would have ended it right there.
So you figured if the bank would cash the checks, there had to be something legit about it, and you could go ahead with this, I'll send you some money, you send me some money thing.
Exactly.
So I'm looking here, okay, we got six checks times $499, we got about $3,000. You send this all to Nigeria, is that what you did?
Yes, yes.
How did you send it? Did you send it in a wire?
Yes, it was Western Union.
And then they were going to send you some money, did they do that?
Yes. Yes.
How much did they send you?
They sent me, at that point, $200.
That's an awful lot of trouble for you to go through for $200.
Right, but if the way they were talking, the more I did it, the more I would be making. And for me not doing anything, it really wasn't that bad. It took maybe an hour to do.
One of the things that I'm trying to figure out, Dan, is at what point my own warning lights would go on, where I'd say, you know what, I don't want to be doing this.
I was always guarded, and actually it was the second sum of traveler's checks that came to me that my warning signals really went up.
How much did they send the second time, just ballpark?
$5,000 worth of traveler's checks.
You take those to the bank?
I took them to the bank, and the bank that I went to at that point told me that they couldn't cash them, that I would have to put them in my account to see if they cleared. On a Monday, I called to see what the status was, and they told me that they didn't clear, that they were fake. As soon as I hung up from the person on the phone from the bank, I called the Rhode Island State Police, and I told them what had happened.
Now, we got a lot of letters after Dan's conversation with Dick Gordon aired. Dennis from Omaha wrote to say, "I was very surprised to hear the story concerning scams. I received one through the mail just last week. I called the number for instructions." And then Dennis writes that the instructions were, "Deposit $2,550 in my checking account and then call back for further details in order that I would receive my $270,000 cash prize by UPS. He says, "I did not deposit the check, and I did not call back for further instructions." Terry from Port Huron, Michigan, wrote to say, "My father has been scammed with the sweepstakes people. He's lost over $12,000. He has dementia, and they've preyed on him over the years with mail and phone calls." He says, "The banks are actually making money off these scams, not losing money. They charged my father huge amounts for passing bad checks. The fees added up as it took them over 2 weeks to notify him. Every time he took one of those checks in, he'd indicate that he was not sure it was good. I don't think these victims are passing bad checks. I think the banks are." Charlie from Creedmoor, North Carolina, wrote us to say, "In the words of the great Charlie Brown, ugh, I was scammed on eBay for over $2,000. Being scammed truly hurt me to my soul. I kept my being scammed a secret from my wife for months, not only because I was ashamed, but because I knew she would kill me." Linda Kelso from Chicago was also listening. She'd been scammed, and she was ashamed, too. In her note, Linda said, "Your story reminded me of my similar experience. Like so many other single adults, nothing would make me happier than to be partnered with an amazing, wonderful man. So I listed my profile on Yahoo Messenger. Now, Linda went on to write that her profile was visited by a charming man named Barry, a contractor who was working in Nigeria. She wrote, "His IM messages were tender. He said he had a bad relationship and he wanted someone he could trust."
Well, he said, this is embarrassing. He kept telling me he loved me and, you know, I mean, I know that's ridiculous. And I said to him, "How can you love me? You've never met me. You really don't know anything about me." And then the response is, "I don't need to know any more about you to know that you're a wonderful, caring person," and generic praise, affection, and support.
He was really pushing all of the right emotional buttons.
Absolutely.
Now, we've been hearing the details of Linda's story this hour, a story that ends with a moment of realization that was as dizzying for Linda as it was disillusioning.
One day he wrote to me that since he was a contractor, he had done some business here in the United States, and he needed someone to receive checks for him because he couldn't cash them in Africa. He had told the person who was sending him the checks that his wife would be receiving the checks.
Ex-wife, rather, the one he had had the bad relationship with and couldn't trust.
No. He was referring to me. You see, he was really pouring it on at that point that he was serious, you know, that this was a real relationship. I had heard about the Nigerian check scams, but for some reason I never thought about it throughout this whole relationship, which was, by the way, about 3 weeks, whatever you can do in 3 weeks. So I'm like, no, I don't think so. He's going on about these checks and, you know, he can trust me. Now you get all the other stuff begins to come into focus. At that point, before he even got any further, I was furious. And I just typed in the word no. And he typed back, "No?" question mark. And I said, "No." And he said, "Why not?" And I said, "I've heard all about these Nigerian check scams, and I'm not cashing a check for anyone. I'm not doing that. I'm not going to receive a check and cash it and send somebody else money. I'm just not doing it." And he said, "Well, are you accusing me of being a scammer?" And I said, "Oh, no, I would never accuse you of being a scammer, but I'm just not doing it." There was a little bit more exchange after that. I don't really remember what it was. And then I said the thing that I'm most embarrassed about. How stupid can you be, all right? I said to him, "But what about us?" And I said, "What am I thinking? There is no us. There was no us." And that was the last I've heard of him.
It's just a real testament to the denial that we'll allow ourselves when we let ourselves be blinded by optimism and romance, I guess.
Well, romance, and yes, it was. And I was for several days, I felt really done, if you know what I mean. I was very angry, and I was angry, I think, mostly at myself for being hopeful that something so shallow could be much deeper than it was.
The whole experience left Linda fuming, and as angry as she was about what this stranger had done to her, as she mentioned, she couldn't help feeling disappointed with herself, too.
It was a revelation to me that at the age of 54, my emotional response to this man had been much the same as any 16-year-old's response to a rock star, you know, or to her boyfriend. I really wanted it to be true. I really wanted it to be true. And when it wasn't, I was angry. I was a little sad. I felt triumphant that the bugger hadn't gotten any money out of me.
Right.
But to that extent, I felt vindicated.
Now, Linda, did you have any intention at that point to call the police or prosecute this guy?
You know, I thought about it. I thought, well, I should at least write to Yahoo Messenger and tell them about this dude, because at the time he had a profile online. And I didn't. I thought, this sounds really petty, but I thought, well, let other women look out for themselves. And then I thought, what good is it going to do? He'll just change his name, change his profile, and go on as George Smith or whatever, you know. There's not much you can do. And then, of course, I had later on, when I heard Dick's show with this other man, the policeman who's interested in tracking these people down, and the policeman had talked about how impossible it was to catch them. And at that point, I thought, well, there's nothing you can do about it. It's really sad. So I guess it's up to us just to tell our stories and let each other know that if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Aaron Henkin. Linda still has her personal profile up on Yahoo Messenger, but she says these days she's much less likely to be swept off her feet.
I'm more skeptical, especially of someone who emails me from out of the country or even from out of the region. I've learned that there are certain things to kind of watch out for, certain phrases, or if someone comes on to me that they care about me so much, you know, or I love you, then I'm basically out of there because it isn't true. You know, it isn't true. If you meet me and we hang out together for a couple days, I think it's possible that you could love me, not as deeply as a relationship that's gone on for years, but affection does begin there. But I'm not going to be snowballed into something that's not good for both people. I'm not doing that. So don't ask for money.
Now, this misadventure happened to you a while ago. You still have your profile online. Any luck since finding a good man?
I've had some wonderful conversations, and I've met some really excellent people. As far as anything permanent, not yet. And I've dated several men and had an enjoyable time and am still in contact with, you wouldn't believe it, a number of them. They come back from time to time to chat, and they're mostly relatively shallow friendships, but the longer they go on, the more people reveal about themselves. And it's just fun to have someone to talk to. It's better than television.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me, Linda, that in this internet world where people can do so much pretending with their identities, your Yahoo Messenger profile is remarkably honest and candid. And I was wondering if I might get you to read from your profile for us.
Sure. It's an amazing world out there. Through this profile, I've met one con man, one angel, one pervert, one illegal alien, and a couple of others somewhere in between. It's great to be out there and meet people that I otherwise would never have met. Don't let my age put you off. Age only matters if you are wine or cheese. I like complexity, mystery, intrigue, little furry creatures, engineers, students, scientists, cooks, carpenters. If you can spin a pun, that's all to the good. What I want out of life, tranquility, a warm place to sleep, someone to talk to. I like to swear. I can't carry a tune in a bucket, but I can write a poem. Come, visit me online.
Linda, do you have at this point any advice that you'd like to share about what to expect or what not to expect?
My advice is go out there and be all out. Go all out. Be cautious. If you feel uncomfortable about what someone is saying or doing, then listen to your conscience or your heart. But, hey, nothing adventured, nothing gained.
Well, Linda Kelso, it's been wonderful talking with you, and I want to wish you the best of luck as you continue to search for that perfect someone out there.
Thank you so much. I'll keep you posted.
Linda Kelso lives in Chicago, Illinois. You can log on to our website to learn more about Linda and where to report online scammers. We're at thestory.org.
my computer world. No longer mean astrology.
Coming up, we'll check in with Joe Cook. Now, when we first met Joe, he told the story of escaping the killing fields of Cambodia. Joe came to the U.S. as a kid and promptly fell in love with baseball. Years later, Joe returned to his home country on a mission to introduce Cambodia to the American pastime. Now, carving out a baseball diamond was the first challenge.
Our field is just a bunch of water buffalo running across the field there. The motorcycle, the bicycle, just run across the field. We don't have fences.
You have water buffalo, motorcycles, and bicycles riding through the middle of the baseball games?
Yes, sir. Just hard to imagine, but we finally able to qualify the very first time that Cambodia qualified to the SEA game. It's like an Asian World Series because of baseball.
An update on the first Cambodian national baseball team in just a moment. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. Welcome back to The Story. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. Baseball season had its official start this week, and so we thought we'd take the occasion to share a story that epitomizes the magic and the spirit of the national pastime. Joe Cook immigrated to the U.S. from Cambodia. He's a man so obsessed with the sport of baseball that although he lives in Alabama and he works as a chef, he's taken it upon himself to personally bankroll the very first Cambodian national baseball team.
I mean, I spend every dime on my savings just to bring baseball across the border to Cambodia. I guess I use baseball as a tool to touch others, to spread, and to help change the society in Cambodia. I told them all these dreams that will come true if I can build a field and I can bring some gloves and ball, things will turn around and have them some hope. And now just spread out through all over the Cambodia.
Joe's roots in Cambodia are deep. He was 5 years old when Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge seized power. Joe's father was a high-ranking government official at odds with the new regime. And there came a time before long when Joe's mother had to take him and his siblings into hiding in the hills near their village. Their father marched off to the battlefront. Joe remembers the last time he saw his dad. He'd come back from the front lines momentarily and found them in their hiding place.
I remember back then he came in after he battled enough just to get to see his family, you know, and said to my oldest brother and said, Troy, you must take over. You know, I will not be with you anymore. I know that's going to happen for sure. He said that you must take care of your family from now on and take them to Thailand border. That's what you're supposed to do. That's his last chance. Because the Khmer Rouge was so powerful, no government military can outpower them. So I remember my father went back out. Within minutes later, I heard so many guns shooting, so many bombs explosion, and you know, a couple of days later, I heard that he was gone. So, yeah.
So he literally walked into a gun battle immediately.
He and his mans, yes, sir.
When the explosions and the gunfire finally subsided, Joe and his family went back down out of the hills to their house. But it wasn't long before the Khmer Rouge marched into town.
They just came through our village. You know, a leader said, you know, everybody must get out the house immediately. And if not, we're going to destroy your house and we're going to bomb it. So everybody kind of jumped out the house. And my mother was the slowest one because she's a little older. So, and she said, they said to my mother, Mama, you got to get out the house right now or I will get a grenade and throw in your house and blow it up. So she's moving very slow, and apparently they went there and grabbed her and got her out, and I couldn't do nothing about that. But I remember also while we got out the house, minutes later, we looked back, all our house burned. Bunch of house in the village, it just burned down to the ground.
Joe ended up in a Khmer Rouge prison camp. He ate leaves, grass, and tree bark, anything he could to keep himself alive during this two-year ordeal. He eventually got up the courage to try and escape. He actually tried 8 times, and on his 9th try...
I see the chance, me and other peoples, and we were just like, this is our chance, do or die, you know. And they turned around and saw that we are fleeting, and they just random shooting everywhere in the bushes, in a tree, and some get hit and some don't.
So you made your escape. Did anyone else from your family escape? Where did you go, and were you able to reunite?
I get reunited with my family. I remember I first met my mother because she's always so close nearby with me. And she came to me, and she hold me, she hugged me, and I was crying, and she does too. And weeks later, I found another brother, and within several weeks later, I found me another brother. But my sister was not there because they all, I mean, 2 of them passed away already. The other sister, by the name of Janti Liang, we didn't know what happened to her. I remember that we got together, we were so happy, and all we could think of, if we can get out of this country, if we ever make, you know, to be alive, if, you know, all we want to do, you know, is to dream and have hope and do good things for others, we can get out of here alive. Yes, sir.
Now, at this point, Joe was only 7 years old. It had been 2 years since he left home. Now, they walked for the next 5 months, barefoot, and somehow made it to Thailand. From there, they came to the U.S. Joe settled in Alabama, where he spent his childhood and adolescence. And it wasn't until years later that he got a phone call. His sister, who he'd given up for dead back in Cambodia, was alive. Joe flew into Thailand and made plans to meet her at the border with Cambodia.
I ride the bus all the way to the Cambodia border, and she would wait for me at the border. And I did not know that she risked her son's life. She sold her son for $47, you know, to one of the boss that, you know, doing a lot of work. So,
Joe, back up there just a second. You say your sister sold her son?
Yes, sir. My nephew was about almost 10 years old back then because she needed the money to go meet me at the border. She wanted to honor her brother, welcome back to Cambodia, to his native land, and want to, you know, to show how much she appreciated for me to, you know, to come. But to do that, she didn't have anything else left other than just, you know, get her son's soul and to get enough money to, you know, ride a taxi all the way to the border and meet me there. So apparently, I didn't know then until I got to the border. I was like, where is your son? She's like, oh, he's still at home. I didn't find out until I got to the capital and asked her, I want to see my nephew. And she's like, well, it's going to cost a lot of money. And I asked her, well, just tell me and I'm willing to get him. You know, just tell him to come meet me. And apparently, I just hand her $100 and she got her son back. And she's like, here's your
Joe,
nephew.
Who in the world did your sister sell her son to?
Well, that's in Cambodia, and life is I mean, it's hard to explain that, but life is cheap, you know. But anyway, while I was there meeting my nephew, my niece, and my nephew was so happy that he's coming back to the family and that I would do something so honored to him. He's like, you know, I want you to, you know, see my friend, my school, my neighbor, my community, and things like that. So I was like, no, I don't want to see that. I've seen enough. But they dragged me out of a bamboo bed and it's like, come on, come with me. So apparently I look at the school, I look at the community, and there was something else when my niece and nephew just pulling my hand and just walked me through there. And I just like, I have to do something about this. So I got to the school and I told the kid, I was like, you know what? When I come back, I'm going to bring baseball.
And that's exactly what Joe Cook did. You're listening to The Story. I'm Aaron Henkin. Turns out the thing Joe had fallen in love with the most about America as a young immigrant, the thing he most wanted to bring back to Cambodia and share with his niece and nephew and their friends, was the crack of the bat. Joe had seen his first baseball game when he was 12. He happened to wander by a Little League game at a ball field where he was staying, and he had no idea what was going on.
Imagine they play baseball and you were blindfolded. You know, you have no clue where's the guys going to, how they score, how they hit, how they play.
But you could tell they were having fun.
Yes, sir. So I began into having, you know, I began to talk to other people that play in baseball. I would say, I want to play. You know, I didn't know how to say the same word, but I expressed my body language, you know, like I was speaking Cambodian. So the coach was like, oh, I think he know what I'm trying to say. So apparently he put me into, you know, into the group, into the team. You know, weeks later, I began to practice and play with them. And I was very happy. You know, a coach gave me a chance to practice with the team, give me a glove, bats, and, you know, and uniform and start playing with the team there. Yes, sir. I was very, very happy back then.
Now, did you became a part of this team? You played games with them?
Yeah, I don't remember what team it was, but it's kind of like a recreation team there, that bunch of kids was playing a team there. And I remember I didn't do too good in baseball, but, you know, I mean, I guess I'm just a new rookie kid, and most of the time, you know, the coach would be, I'm the last guy to be in the game, you know, if we win or lose, and at the end of the game, he'll throw me out there in the outfield or let me pitch at the last, you know, inning or so, and that's very exciting to me.
You were like 12 years old at this point. Did, as you got older, did you continue to play? I mean, did you play in high school?
Yeah, I continued to play for the school, the elementary school, and also the junior high. And after that, I just began to play. I didn't get a chance to play in high school. I was working because my mother and my family moving to the West Coast, and I was all alone. I had to go to high school and, you know, trying to support myself. But baseball is always in my heart. I love it so much and always wanted to play as much as I can.
So Joe Cook set out to bring baseball to Cambodia. On his salary as a chef in a Japanese steakhouse in Dothan, Alabama, he funds and remotely manages several baseball leagues in Cambodia, from Little League up through the very first Cambodian national team. Now, even at that top level, the Cambodian players make do with secondhand equipment and makeshift baseball diamonds.
Off field, just a bunch of water buffalo running across the field there. The motorcycle, the bicycle, just run across the field. We don't have fences.
You have water buffalo, motorcycles, and bicycles riding through the middle of the baseball games?
Yes, sir. And we basically, you know, practice each and every day, you know, bare feet, hot heat. But I guess baseball has always been into me. And I just wanted to do so much with baseball. Just hard to imagine, but these days, we finally able to qualify the very first time that Cambodia qualified to the SEA Games. It's like an Asian World Series because of baseball.
Why do you think you did this, Joe? What inspired you, and why baseball?
Well, because I survived through so many, and I see so much that happened to the country, to the children. And I lost my nephew. You know, I knew that I can do something, and I knew baseball will help. And, you know, right now, what inspires me is the children playing baseball and to reach and play international. That's what inspires me. That's what's keep me going.
Now, that was last August when I spoke with Joe, and in the time since our conversation, he did indeed take his team to the international baseball tournament, the Southeast Asia Games, or SEA Games. This is The Story. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. I got the chance to follow up with Joe this week. We talked on the phone, and he told me the first team Cambodia played in the series was Thailand, the number one ranked team in the conference.
It was great. Everybody was excited to come out and play their heart out. You know, the pitcher was out there doing his job, you know, able to focus on the strike zone. You know, I able to talk to them that no matter what, win or lose, we're here. That's the most honorable. And to me, the first game that I like them to do was just throw strike and play your own game and have fun. Mm-hmm. So on our first game, we were blown out with 16-0. We played about 4.5 inning. We are visitor and they are the home team. So they have a mercy rule. If they are over 12 points or more at 5 inning, they decide to have a mercy rule. So
the score aside, I can imagine, Joe, that it must have just been an awesome experience to be there and see your team suited up and out there on the field in that big environment.
Yes, sir. We made a lot of record on our first game.
A lot of records, you say?
Yes, sir. The pitcher able to throw the first strike, the first ball he pitched out there right there on the mound.
Oh, that's great.
The guy didn't even swing and hit it. I mean, he swung, but he couldn't hit the ball.
Wow.
And then we got the first strike out. That's all in the record book.
That's incredible.
And we threw a curveball, and that's the first curveball in our book. We threw a knuckleball. So every detail there, there's a record for us to grab and to get.
So you guys were setting records pretty much with everything you did out there on the field, this being your first official game.
Yes, sir. Even though we lost the game, we focused on what we need to do, to grab many records as possible, you know, to get there. So this will be remembered for the rest of our country life in baseball.
Now, Joe, when we last spoke, you told me the story of your nephew and you buying him back when you came back to the country. And I understand he was part of the team?
Yes, sir. My little nephew that was sold to someone else. And I bought him back. And, you know, 5 years later, he's playing for the national team. He's 16 years old. He did great on his first game. He's playing with the Malaysian team. He had three strikeouts.
So he pitched against a game when you were playing Malaysia?
Yeah, and he did very well. He got three strikeouts.
Wow.
He struck three guys out.
That must have been great to see your nephew out there on the pitcher's mound after everything he's been
through.
Well,
at first, I kind of, you know, think that he was so young. He's 16 years old, but, you know, he's been playing baseball ever since I started out there because he always mentioned to me that I'm the guy that brought back his life from, you know, out there. It was very rough for him. So baseball is not hard for him. He said that if he ever get a chance to be on the mound, and he would love to, you know, to give his best. So,
when your nephew came off the field after those four innings, what did you have to say to him?
I say, you did great. You know, I'm very proud of you. I mean, as an uncle, I don't want to let him know that I love him so much and I don't want to brag so much about him. I said that, pat on the back and say, you did a great job. I'm proud of you. And give him a smile, thumbs up, and high five. And he begged to sit down. And he said that, you know, he wished he can do better. And I said, well, you did what I asked you to do, so great job.
I'm sure he knew how proud you were inside.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So this was your first official appearance at the SEA Games. Do you guys have plans to come back next year?
We'll definitely show it up again. We're not afraid because this is the opportunity for everyone, for the name of baseball, and everybody would just love to be there. So it's my duty to be able to bring them, you know, to the tournament.
Now, everybody over in Cambodia knows you as the grandfather of Cambodian baseball. You're obviously stretching yourself really thin to be able to manage all this. I mean, it's clearly a labor of love. Why baseball for Cambodia?
Because the game was not there, and the children, they need hope and they need joy, and I can do this with baseball because the things that I love, the thing that I have passion with, and I'm falling in love with baseball, and I enjoy every moment of it. And if I can do anything to help, and I'll do it. So without baseball, well, you know, we just, you know, didn't have no heroes. And baseball done that just like we did out there in the SEA Games. Everybody would just dream to do that.
Joe Cook lives in Dothan, Alabama. He funds the Cambodian national baseball team through local donations and $47,000 worth of loans. You can find out more about Joe and his efforts to bring baseball to Cambodia at thestory.org. How about you? Baseball season just opened up this week. Have you got a special passion for the game? A story about another sport that's changed your life? Drop us a note. We'd love to hear from you. We're at The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, 27517. Zip code again, 27517. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. From American Public Media, this is The Story.
This story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.